To celebrate our first quarter century and to inaugurate our next 25 years, the Boston Sangerfest Men's Chorus commissioned Lou Spratlin, professor of music at Amherst College, to compose a salute to the chorus and to the American culture in which so much of our music has its roots. Professor Spratlin is a prolific composer of operatic, chamber works, solo music, choral music, and film music. He has received numerous fellowships and awards, including Guggenheim, Rockefeller, and NEA fellowships, an American Academy of Arts and Letters Composer Award, and the 2000 Pulitzer Prize in Music for his opera Life is a Dream. I'm delighted that Professor Spratlin has agreed to join me this evening to talk about the piece he has composed, New England Concordance, which has its premiere at our concert at the Carey Hall in Lexington on June 3rd. So, Lou, before we talk about the piece itself, the New England Concordance, could you tell us just a little bit about your background? I understand, for example, that you were at one time actively involved in male choral singing.
Yes. Actually, my singing experience goes way back to when I was a kid. So I've been very involved in singing from a very early age. And then I went to school at Yale, and the Yale Glee Club was in full swing.
Right.
At that time, and I sang with them with great pleasure, went on tours with them, and led the whole life, which was rather grand, and had this particular male chorus experience, of course, at Yale. So, yes, I've been involved in singing. I've never done solo singing. It's all been ensemble singing. But it was a very important part of my life.
I know our members will be familiar with the fact that you have won the Pulitzer Prize Award and that it was for an opera that you composed, but there was a slightly unusual element to that award, wasn't there? Do you want to mention that?
Extremely unusual. Yeah, I was commissioned by the New Haven Opera Theater to write this piece. In fact, the text, which is the great Golden Age theater piece by Calderon, was handed to me by the director of that company. She invited me to, Hertha Glatz was her name, she invited me to do this piece, and I said, well, I'm flattered, I'd love to take it on, but I have no idea about a text. And she handed me a copy of the text in English for Life is a Dream, La Vida es Sueño. And I read it over that night and became absolutely compelled by it. It's a phenomenal Shakespearean era
right.
Spanish drama, and I was completely caught by it and said yes right away. She was married to the director of chair of the Yale School of Medicine at the time, and he moved to L.A. and she went along, and they couldn't find anybody to move into her shoes there.
Right.
In New Haven, and the company floundered and finally ceased to exist. But by that time, I was three-quarters of the way through the third and final act, which was, I was left high and dry with it. And I shopped it around for a number of years, but didn't get any takers at all, and finally just gave up on it and put it on the shelf, so to speak. I was encouraged by a composer friend of mine who heard we had done one little 10-minute snippet of it, that I had a recording of, and I played it for Roger Reynolds, who's a composer from San Diego, who happened to be in residence at Amherst one year. And he said, this is great stuff. How can you just let it sit there? And that emboldened me to raise some money. And I put on a concert performance, totally unstaged performance of the second act in the year 2000. And it was a big success. It was we did it twice, once in Amherst and once at Payne Hall
right.
at Harvard. And the word was out. I mean, people had sort of known about this opera for years. I finished it in 78. Here we are, and come the year 2000. And so we put it on. It was a huge success. And I, as I frequently do with large pieces, submitted it to the Pulitzer Committee. And to my amazement, I mean, true amazement, I
yeah.
won the Pulitzer. But not that I don't feel that the music is strong, but the problem is it was just one act
right.
of a three-act opera. And I thought there's no way in the world they were going to award a prize on the basis of a third of an opera. But it happened, and I was completely, blindsided. I had submitted it more or less routinely, and then wham. And I thought, well, now I'm going to have to be fighting them off. Everybody's didn't want to produce it. And I had to wait another 10 years before it was finally produced. The Santa Fe Opera had a new general director, a marvelous, absolutely wonderful, inspired man named Charles McKay, who wanted to follow in the tradition of the Santa Fe Opera and put on at least one brand new work every year. And he hadn't had time to develop anything because he was new there in the post. And he sent letters around to publishers. And fortunately, this piece was published, and my G. Shermer, my publisher, sent it out to him, and he was taken by it, and they decided to do a production. So there's been a lot of waiting from 78 when I finished to 2000 when the one act was put on, and finally 2010 it got staged. And it was a phenomenal production. Very, very great from every point of view.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it was well deserved, and I suppose the nearest equivalent to that in the acting world would be somebody getting an Oscar for three quarters of a movie.
Exactly. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah. Now, turning towards the piece that you have composed for us, the New England Concordance, I'm just interested if you can explain the process that you used a little bit to move from the conceptual framework that Tom Berryman would have given you through to the development and then finalizing the finished piece.
Sure. We had a wonderful dinner. There were the four sort of senior figures, including Tom. I had been, I guess, fairly highly recommended by various people, and they were expecting this would probably go ahead, but we spent a lot of the time talking about what the general topic might be, and fairly early on, it became clear that it would be good for it to be, in the most general sense, on a New England subject somehow.
Yes.
I mean, it's the home of the chorus, and they've done a number of Randall Thompson pieces, which of course they're doing on this program as well.
Yes.
And something which I was very happy to take up. I've been a New Englander, transplanted New Englander since 1970, and was happy to investigate this. I first of all thought about some Frost text, but Tom, not surprisingly, felt that they were maybe a little dark for this event.
Frost
has rather a somber edge to him, even though on the face of it, it's rather upbeat poetry. And so that got sort of, I just went on a text hunt. And mainly online, and I can't tell you precisely how I ended up here, but I found a number of poems by Louisa May Alcott, which surprised me because I know her only as I had known her only as the author of Little Women, and I was surprised that surprised that she'd done any poetry,
yes.
And I was very taken by the Thoreau's Flute, which I think is rather a fine poem in and of itself, and loaded with substantial appreciation for what Thoreau stands for in New England culture, and, you know, in American culture generally. He's quite a looming figure. And I fairly early on decided that I wanted to set this Alcott, but I didn't want to, I can't tell you why this is the case, but I didn't want to simply take a poem and set it. I had, from the outset, I had wanted to do a kind of pairing. And so I have a close friend who's an expert, very, very thoroughly aware of the sacred harp tradition. I don't know if you're
Yes.
aware of that. It's a collection. It's a long-standing collection of American hymns.
Yes.
And many of them stemming from the British Isles as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I called Tim, and I described this Alcott poem, and I said, could you come up with some Sacred Heart hymns that resonate with the Alcott and extend it or comment on it? And the very next day, he sent me five or six, and one had a huge star by it, and
yeah.
It was New Concord, the poem that I chose, text by Samuel Stennett, and you've sung the piece. I mean, you're aware of how congruent they are.
Yes,
those
absolutely.
Two pieces of text.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we very much appreciate and enjoy that confluence, if you like, between the themes that Alcott introduced and then how it's carried on in Stennett's piece.
No, I was thrilled.
Yeah.
The Amherst College Library and found it,
yes.
And I thought, this is perfect. So that's where this all came about. It started with the Alcott, and then I wanted to have pair it with something, and I found the Stennett hymn to go with it.
Yes.
And I sent the text off to Tom and his colleagues, and they all seemed quite happy about them. Thought it was seemed right down the line in terms of what they were hoping for. And once I got a sort of okay there, I dove in. I very, very much enjoyed writing this piece. Not only was it a reflection of my male chorus background, but a thorough has long been a kind of hero of mine. So it had a kind of double resonance for me. The male chorus aspect of it, and also the fact that it touched on Thoreau, which was personally very meaningful to me.
And of course, as someone originally from the UK, I was wondering, slightly tongue in cheek, whether your choice of an 18th century English hymn as the second part of the concordance was a deliberate nod to the closeness of the links between Britain and the US then.
Well, I would be fibbing if I said yes. I don't think that's something that I thought very much about, although it's certainly there.
Yeah. Yeah,
that whole American hymn tradition comes directly from the British Isles.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's not something that I thought carefully about when I was writing the piece, but I certainly acknowledge it.
Yes, understood. So you attended a rehearsal before you took this commission on. How much of an impact did that have on you in terms of the extent to which the sound and tone and general feel of the chorus influenced how you approached the composition?
Considerably, although I have to back up and say that Tom had sent me online a recording of the Second Fest chorus, so which I'd listened to pretty thoroughly before I attended that rehearsal. So I was very aware of the sound and vigor of the group before I actually heard them. And having been prepared that way from hearing the recording, I was that general impression I had was continued when I heard the rehearsal. It's a very vigorous, focused, energetic sound. I was surprised by the size of the group. It was bigger than I was anticipating. So I had in mind exactly, very much what the chorus sounded like, and I tried to, stay within reason there. I mean, there are no
keys
for the tenors and so on.
Yes.
And nothing out of range on the bottom end either. I'd done all this singing with the Yodeling Club, so I was very aware of what the sort of standard ranges for each of the four parts were, and it was, but it was very helpful.
You also mentioned in some notes you provided us that you talked about the role that the piano would play, and I think you mentioned on occasion it leads, but for the most part it's more of a subservient role. How do you decide on that? What were the kind of factors that...
Well, quite conceivable. I could have written an a cappella piece. It wouldn't have had to have piano at all, but
yes.
I know what the realities of the situation are. I mean, it's not right. Singing a piece of that length without any tonal support from another instrument would be very difficult.
Yes.
And I made the decision early on that I was going to use a piano. I like to think that the piano is not obtrusive at all. It supports what's going on harmonically and melodically, just enough to give the singer something to lean on, but I didn't want it to have any kind of central place. It gets,
yes,
in the second song, it gets kind of active towards the end. That's probably the most elaborate thing the piano does in the whole piece. But the main answer to your question is that I felt it was necessary for a piece of that length to have some tonal support for it.
Well, as we look forward, we've had one concert last year when we looked back on our first 25 years. And this concert, as you know, is intended to really position us over the next 25 years. Do you have any particular message you would like to relay to the chorus? Any advice?
Well, keep it up. I mean, I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Tom is marvelous. I really admire his enterprise and leadership and musicianship. I think he's you're very fortunate to have him as a leader. I applaud it. I think it's a marvelous opportunity for these people to stay passionate about something they love and to make contact. And the one thing that amazed me when Tom told me about it, I don't know whether it's still true, is that you memorize everything you sing, which is very... Is that true?
We do. It's true.
Yeah. I mean, that in itself is an indicator of the sort of dedication of the group, because it takes a lot to memorize a program of that size, and the fact that people are willing to do it is a very impressive thing to me. I wish you a very happy 25, and then beyond that, another 50.
Well, Lou, on behalf of the Boston Sanger Fest Men's Chorus, I really would like to thank you for spending time on this call this evening, and for helping to position us with your wonderful composition, New England Concordance, for our next 25 years.